start of it as well. Well, hello. My name's Andrea. I'm the head of medicine here at Paragon Referrals.
My name's Nick, and I'm one of the registered veterinary nurses at Paragon.
And hopefully we're going to give you a fun-filled talk, 20 minutes or so, about blood products, when we use them, how to monitor transfusions for them, and information, loads of information I don't know about the Pet Blood Bank and how you actually get hold of these products. So we hope you find it interesting. I'll bring up our PowerPoint so you can see the questions that we thought were most relevant. I think that's in the slide. We'll see. So then, I'll start off answering the first one. What are the most common conditions that require blood transfusions? And I'd say in the patients that present to us at Paragon, and I guess from my experience in general practice as well, the most common would be the immune-mediated diseases. So IMHA, immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, and immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, low platelets. The other ones I think would be on that list would be dogs or cats as well that have lost a lot of blood from bleeding problems, usually acquired problems when they've eaten something like rodenticide poisoning, and they've got that. So they have a blood clotting problem and they lose a lot of blood and need a blood transfusion. How they present is usually as a consequence of their level of anemia, and with the immune-mediated diseases, it's their systemic inflammation that's making them feel unwell as well. So just the vague signs of lethargy and poor appetite, but they also often will be signs related to the anemia. So they might be exercise intolerant, they might have collapsed, their gums are often pale. With the dogs that have got coagulopathies from, say, vitamin K, you often don't see any outward signs of bleeding with that. It's usually within cavities that happen. And again, there'll be similar signs of lethargy and collapse. They can have quite profound hematomas, so blood-filled areas form after, say, an injection underneath the skin. Or if you take a jugular blood sample, they can bleed quite profoundly after that. And then with the IMTP, the thrombocytopenic patients, they often will have bruises throughout their skin, often known as will report bleeding from the gums, say in the water bowl, and also if they swallow that blood or if they've got bleeding from the gastrointestinal tract, they'll have melena as well, so black stools. Where do you start these investigations? With any investigation, the best place to start is with a good history and with a good clinical exam. So the things particularly in histories that I'd be wanting to take with patients that are presenting with likely anemias are, have they had any recent medications, any recent trauma? Have they got access to rodenticides in their vicinity? And have the owners noticed any signs of blood loss, particularly what the sort of more hidden ones like melena, the black stools? On physical exam, you want to be doing your full physical exam, but particularly paying attention to the cardiovascular stability. So heart rate, how the pulses feel, are they bounding or are they quite poor? Looking in hidden places as well for petechiae, so that bruising that can happen on the gums or the third eyelid, on the skin. With auscultation, I'd be paying attention to, is there a sort of fluid line in the chest? So could there be a hemothorax? And you'll see it here, dull lung sounds ventrally, if that's the case. Or on abdominal palpation, is there a fluid thrill in the abdomen? So Nick, let me ask you, what's the nurse's role in these types of cases?
I think nurses can do quite a lot with IMHA and IMTP cases. It starts usually with taking blood samples to see what's going on with the anemia. And nurses will typically always take that and be able to then run lab results either in-house or sending off to the lab for analysis. Something we do here at Paragon quite a lot is the vets are quite good at getting us to do quite a lot with IMHA and IMTP cases. So we'd usually look at things like potentially an in-house hematology, a PCV, total protein readings, and then report those back to the vet just for a primary review of kind of how those blood results are looking. We'll do things as well like in saline agglutination tests, which is something that I hadn't done until coming to Paragon, but it's something that we now do very regularly. And these are just done by taking a blood sample into a normal EDTA tube and then placing one drop of blood onto a microscope slide, and then mixing that with between one and four drops of saline, depending where you read kind of how the technique should be done. But we usually do one drop to one drop of blood. Generally rotate the microscope slide just to mix those two together, and then have a look both just subjectively how it looks on the slide and then under the microscope. So what we'll look for is a clumping of the cells, because the IMHA causes the red blood cells to be covered in antibodies, and then when mixed with saline, you'll get two different appearances depending on whether it's a positive agglutination or not. And you'll have the cells looking clumped together almost like a bunch of grapes when you look at it under a microscope at 10 times focus. You can also look on the microscope slide yourself, and it'll look kind of like a sandy kind of appearance. There'll be quite a difference with a negative test, where it would normally just look like watered down blood. With a positive result, you'll get this kind of speckledy, sandy appearance, which is a positive result, and then suggests there's a hemolytic breakdown of the red blood cells at that point, which you can then report back to your vet. One thing that I think is really handy as well is if you are looking on microscope slides, there's a website that Cornell University have from their veterinary medicine team, and it's got a really good database of how red cells and all blood cells actually look under a microscope. And you can just bring up the website, have a look at what you're seeing under the microscope, and it will tell you what type of cell that is. And it's got really good step-by-step guides of how to do some of these soft tests that we do for IMHA and IMTP cases. We also do buccal mucosal bleeding time tests quite a lot, which is usually assessing primary hemostasis and the function of platelets in the patient that we're looking at. There's kits available, which we'll come on to later, you can get from Pet Blood Bank. There's a few other places that you can get them from as well. And it's basically a little device that you put onto the patient's lip mucosa, click a button, and it makes a little slice into the lip. And then what you need to then do is time how long it takes for the blood to stop from the cut that you've made. And to do that, you just dab away the extra blood that's kind of coming down with, there's a little blotting device that will come with the packs, or you can also use a swab. But the key thing to do is to not disturb the clot that's forming, and just to dab away the kind of excess blood.
And that can be quite tricky at times. Yeah. When you've got a patient that's wriggling all over the place, you're trying to hold the lip up. It can often be a 2-3-4 person job to try and keep them still enough, not occlude any blood vessels, and keep trying to not disturb that clot.
Yeah, if you do, you can do it with sedated patients, but you're looking at normally a 2-4 minute time where that blood should stop for a normal result. But in sedated patients, it can take a little bit longer for that to happen. But it is something that you can do with sedated patients. It's just adjusting the timeline that you're really looking for. Other things that we can do, so if we decide a patient needs a transfusion, that will always come to the nurses here for preparing that, getting the equipment ready, working out the calculations for how much blood's needed to get a desired PCV, and for just making sure the blood's ready to be administered. And we'll do things like blood typing to make sure the right blood is given to the patient, cross-matching if it's from a donor or if the patient's had a transfusion previously. And they're all done with kits that we can do in-house. They're fairly relatively easy tests to do. It takes just a few minutes to do in-house. And then we'll also do with monitoring of the transfusion. So that will come to the nurse, and that can be a four-hour job for a nurse to closely monitor that patient while they're receiving a transfusion. So it's definitely a nurse-involved type of cases where you kind of take the lead in the case once you've decided on the treatment that you're going to give. And there'll usually be a nursing practice as well that will be responsible for ordering those products, making sure they're in stock, and keeping a register of kind of what blood products are being administered to patients.
Another thing I think to mention as well, going from that primary sort of screen that Nick's talked about with a lot of those tests, is what other investigations you might want to do with these kind of patients that present. An external hematology will be really helpful. So you get an assessment of, is this anemia regenerative or non-regenerative? So looking at the reticulocyte count, you can get a clinical pathologist to review the slide to look for abnormalities that might give you some clues as to where the problem might be. So those typical cells, spherocytes, that you see in immune-mediated disease, they're small, more spherical, lack of central pallid cells, they can give you a very good clue as to that you're dealing with an immune-mediated disease. The typical causes of the regenerative anemias would be blood loss or hemolysis. And if it's non-regenerative, just remember that if a dog's had a significant bleed, they'll be pre-regenerative for about 3 to 5 days. It takes that period of time to have an appropriate response. So if they have had a bleed, you expect them within 3 days or so to be having a regenerative response to it. Coombs test can be helpful sometimes if you're questioning, is this an immune-mediated disease? It might help you with your diagnosis. It's not a completely reliable test, but it's there as an option. And then if you do diagnose an immune-mediated disease, you then want to think about screening. So is there an underlying trigger? And that might be done with further bloods, looking for infectious disease and imaging to look for abnormalities in the chest and abdomen. So if you've got a dog that needs a transfusion, how do you monitor that?
So we've got our own sheet in-house that allows us to monitor these patients, but the Pet Blood Bank have a really good sheet on their website. When you first look at it, it looks really detailed and quite complicated, but it's just quite a thorough check of the patient. So if you go onto the Pet Blood Bank website, there is a downloadable sheet that's completely free of charge to have a look at on there that will, if you fill in all the boxes, will make sure it's a really comprehensive assessment of the patient prior to giving the transfusion and then during the transfusion, what you need to be looking for. So what we do is we always place a second IV line for these patients, just so the blood can be given via one IV, and if they are on any other medications or fluids at any point, then that can run through a separate line. The main things that we monitor are heart rate, respiratory rate, the effort for the respiratory pattern, the patient's temperature, blood pressure, and then we note things like if there's any vomiting episodes or anything like that. And it's important, as I said, the first thing to do is to get a baseline for that patient. So it may be that it's not your normal values because of the condition that they're experiencing, but to get an idea of where they are prior to the transfusion, just to allow you to monitor for any changes that occur during that potentially 4 hours that you're giving that transfusion to the patient. There are some adverse effects that can happen. So we will always have a multi-parameter set up on the patient. So that will tell us usually an ECG pattern, which will then obviously give us the heart rate. We'll have a rectal probe for the temperature to be monitored easily. And then we'll have blood pressure via that as well. And that will be the same machine that we take the baseline readings from, just so there's some consistency with those readings. And then we always keep the same nurse with that patient as well, just to be able to monitor them nice and closely. In terms of any adverse effects, there are some that are more common than others. And there are some that when you're kind of reading about giving transfusions sound quite dramatic, but it's just keeping an eye on kind of what can happen during those transfusions. So you can get symptoms such as fever, nausea, you can get tachycardia, tachypnea, and you can get hypotension with these patients as well. I suppose the good thing in a way is that if you are getting a reaction, it's something that you see quite quickly and early in the transfusion, and it's sometimes quite an obvious reaction that you're seeing, but some are a little bit more subtle, which is why we need to keep an eye on them. So when we're monitoring these patients, we'll monitor them closely every sort of 5 minutes for the first half an hour of the transfusion and take a reading of all those, all the readings that we're looking at that I've just mentioned for that kind of period every 5 minutes to start with. When we're happy that there's no reaction occurring after half an hour, we'll extend that to kind of every 10, 15 minutes and then just keep an eye on the patient from there. You can get some severe reactions that are sort of respiratory distress, edema that can cause an upper airway obstruction, quite a depressed mentation in the patient, so they'll suddenly change their demeanour. And you can also get severe hypotension, which again you would know from taking your baseline reading and seeing quite a dramatic change in that. When they occur, the first thing as a nurse is to alert your vet. So any sign of anything where you think there's a bit of a change occurring, we're always quite proactive in alerting the vet and letting them have a look at what's going on. I think there's quite a few different things depending on the reaction, as to kind of what you would then
exactly do next. So it's it depends on what type of reaction as well. So the majority of signs that you were talking about there are all from a most likely seen in a hemolytic type of reaction. So the donor that's receiving it's breaking down the red blood cells, or vice versa. In those kind of cases, when you're having those severe reactions, so if there is dyspnea, tachypnea, if there's evidence of severe change in mentation, low blood pressure, or a real spike in temperature, then and the other things to look out for as well is a change in the colour of the urine. So hemoglobinuria is a classic sign of hemolysis within the blood vessels. We'd stop it straight away if they were severe. And most likely, if it is a hemolytic reaction, you don't want to continue at all with that transfusion. That would put the patient at further risk. If they are hypotensive, you want to be managing that with crystalloid boluses, so to try and improve their volume status. You can give things like antihistamines, so chlorpheniramine, and you can give things like steroids. They are medications that probably don't make actually that much difference. They probably make more difference if you actually give them presumptively and stop that histamine release, but it's not something you would routinely do. The other type of reaction is more of a less severe reaction. That would be a non-hemolytic reaction. That's the often you can see sort of swelling around the periorbital region. They might be itchy and have wheals and welts come up. In that kind of reaction, an antihistamine might be helpful to try and stop further histamine release. But that wouldn't be a case that I'd necessarily stop the transfusion. I might monitor them a bit more closely, but having that kind of reaction is something that isn't life-threatening. When do you decide whether these patients need transfusions? There isn't a black and white cutoff, and it is very, very individual. The main parameter really, or main assessment, is are they cardiovascularly unstable? So do they need oxygen carrying capacity? And that would be based on the demeanour of the patient. Are they in a collapsed state? Are they really, really quiet? Their heart rate, and ideally heart rate when they're not anxious or not excited, when they're resting. And again, a resting heart rate of over sort of 120, 140 would be consistent with being cardiovascularly unstable. The way that the pulses feel, so they might be poor quality, so you can't really feel them very well, or they could be really bounding and the dog's trying to compensate. And also the actual PCV results. So from that initial result that Nick talked about that you get, you can have some ideas. So when you're getting down to the sort of low teens and certainly below 10, it is very likely that the patient will need a transfusion, but it depends how quickly that anemia is dropped. If it's a chronic anemia, so from bone marrow disease, and the patient's gradually reduced over a period of weeks and months, they compensate very well. And you could have patients coming in with a PCV of 10 that are cardiovascularly stable and bright because their body's compensated. And you can have a dog that's had an acute loss of blood from rodenticide toxicity because they've got a heboabdomen, and they've gone from a normal PCV down to 15, and they're completely unstable and collapsed. So it really depends on the patient making that decision. So Nick, tell me about the sharing scheme. I don't know anything about the Pet Blood Bank.
So Pet Blood Bank, as the name suggests, have a stock of blood in the UK for veterinary practice to be able to access to give transfusions. It's to save you having to have a kind of donor list of usually staff pets that are available at short notice for transfusions. It's a company that have kind of, they have patroid blood cells, things like frozen plasma, fresh frozen plasma, cryoprecipitate, all sorts of different blood products. And they have them, they're based in Loughborough, which from Paragon is about sort of 2 or 3 hours away. And they can distribute blood at fairly short notice to get that to your practice to be able to then administer a blood product to a patient. The blood sharing scheme is a number of practices that includes kind of like Vets Now practices and ourselves here at Paragon, where we have blood on the premises in stock that would allow kind of urgent transfer of blood to a local practice. So if you were to order directly from the pet blood bank that we'll touch on in a moment, it usually takes about 4 hours at least for them to get that product over to you. And that's within working hours. They do sometimes able to do out of hours, but it takes longer because they have to arrange couriers and things like that. So if there is a practice local to you, you can get that product very quickly and get it to the patient a lot quicker. On the Pet Blood Bank website, there's a location finder that will tell you, you just put in the postcode that your practice is in and a radius that you're happy to travel, and it will tell you all the practices that are available within that radius, their opening hours, how to contact them, and what products they have available as well. So for ourselves here, we have always, or we try and always have a unit of packed red cells that are DEA 1.1 negative and positive, and we also have fresh frozen plasma and frozen plasma in stock, but each practice has a different stock level, just depending on what facilities they have to store them and for the stock that Pet Blood Bank have available to send out for them to store. So if your practice is closer, then you're able to potentially get that blood a little bit quicker than the 4 hours it takes for Pet Blood Bank to deliver it to you directly. If you need to get the blood, just contact the practice directly and they'll be able to let you know what's in stock and arrange for that to be done. It also costs no extra money to get it from a sharing scheme practice than it would directly from Pet Blood Bank. So it's much more quicker and the same cost to be able to get it directly from a sharing practice. So it's definitely something we want to try to promote and get people to use because there's quite a lot of practices that are out part of the blood sharing scheme.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. Yeah, it's really a lot more accessible. The commonly used products, I'd say that packed red cells are the very most common when patients need that oxygen carrying capacity. I think probably second would be a form of plasma. That can be, as Nick said, frozen or fresh frozen. There's a slight difference between the clotting factors and von Willebrand's factor that's more labile and lost after a year. So I think it's factor 3-8 and von Willebrand's are the main important ones that you lose from fresh frozen to frozen. And then the other one would be fresh whole blood. I think it's reasonably rare that you actually need to give fresh whole blood. You often either just need the packed red cells or the clotting factors. But I guess if you've got a dog that has lost a lot of blood from a bleeding problem and they are cardiovascularly unstable and they need clotting factors, it's a good option. And then there really isn't a product to provide platelets. They don't, yes, in fresh whole blood, they might be around for a few hours, but they don't stay and it's rarely used that that you actually want to be able to give an animal platelets. The last question for you, Nick. What's the ordering process for Pet Blood Bank?
So it's really easy. You can order online, just register with the Pet Blood Bank website, and they'll be able to then make recurring orders for you. Or you can just call them. Again, the number's on the website there. They do work normal kind of opening hours, I think it's between 9 and 5. And you'll get straight through to the Pet Blood Bank. But out of hours, you can ring and you'll get through to Vets Now in Glasgow, who deal with it out of hours for them. As I said earlier, it's usually 4 hours for an urgent blood delivery. But if it's potentially a surgical case that you've got coming in that may need a transfusion intraoperatively, you can ring them and deliver it next day if you want to do that as well. You can get whole blood. It's not something that any of the sharing practices would keep in stock. And it's not something that the Pet Blood Bank themselves have in stock generally, but they can, if there's a donation session that they run where people take their dogs to donate blood, they can arrange for it to be transferred directly from a donor session to the practice if you really do need it. But it does then need to be administered within 4 to 6 hours from being collected. So if you give them a ring and you do need whole blood, they'll be able to work out the best option for you. We had one case a few weeks ago, or months ago, where we did get whole blood and they got it to us within a couple of hours because there was one going on about 45 minutes from where we are. So if you ever need anything and you just want to discuss it with somebody, they're definitely worth a call just to speak to and see what availability there is. You can also order everything else for doing transfusions and anything else to do with blood disorders, really. So you can get the administration kits to do transfusions, all the filters, collection sets for collecting your own blood if there is a dog that you're able to get blood from, typing kits and the buccal mucosal bleeding time kits are all available directly from them or on the website. So they're definitely, if you're not registered with them already, to get registered would be a really good idea, and it's really useful for cases like these.
Awesome, thank you. That was really helpful information. I feel like I learned stuff actually. How it works at Pet Blood Bank. So we're always on the phone as well. I think Pet Blood Bank are a really helpful resource, and the medicine team here, the vets and nurses, are really happy to help you through if it's something that's new to you, doing blood transfusions, helping you with those practicalities and case selection. So let us know. We're on the end of the phone or email. Thanks for listening, everyone.